Welcome to another safety class, and today we're going to talk about subpart K, which is electrical work. Remember that one of the four areas of focus for OSHA right now, which are the focus four, includes electrocution, which is the result of misuse of electrical appliances or electrical current. So today we're going to learn about what are the dangers and the hazards associated with electricity and how to protect against these different hazards. Some of the most frequent citations related to electrical work include branch circuits, ground fault protection, assured equipment grounding conductor program, lack of that, grounding path, ground fault circuit interrupters, GFCIs, guarding live parts, and equipment installation and use. These are some of the most frequently cited violations related to electricity. What are the dangers of electricity? Basically, 5 people die every week out of electrocution. It causes the death of 12% of the younger workforce. Basically, most of those who die, or a large amount of those who die, are young people in the construction industry who do not have enough experience to the exposure and protection from electrical current. In addition to the risk of electrocution, we also have another risk related to electricity, which is the risk of fire. So fire may result from electrical misuse. So today we're going to talk about 6 different types of electrical hazards. 3 of them are direct and 3 are indirect. The direct ones include shock, which is an electrical shock that might not kill, electrocution, which is death due to electrical shock, and the third one is burns due to electrical shock as well. The indirect ones, if someone gets shocked while working on a platform, they might fall. So number four is falls. Number 5 is fires. Again, if not paid attention to, that electrical current may ignite something which might cause fire. And if that thing that's going to be ignited is explosive, then it might cause, in addition to fire, an explosion as well. So basically, 6 types of electrical hazards, 3 direct and 3 indirect. When does an electrical shock happen? It happens when the current flows through the body. An electrical shock is received when electrical current passes through the body. And when you are in the loop, when the person that's being shocked is in the loop. So you will get an electrical shock if a part of your body completes the electrical circuit by touching a live wire or an electrical ground, or touching a live wire and another wire at a different voltage. So as long as there's a difference in the voltage between the two wires, this is going to cause an electrical shock, because the difference is going to go through the body of that person holding the two wires. So it shows here, for example, this is the source of electricity, and then you're standing on another metal, for example, which is conducts electricity. So the circuit is closed through your body, and that's where the shock happens. The severity of the shock depends on the path of the current through the body, the amount of current or the intensity of the current flowing through the body, and that's going to be measured in amperes or amps, and the duration of the shocking current through the body. Of course, the longer the exposure, the more severe the injury is going to be. Low voltage does not mean low hazard, and that's a misconception, because people think, oh, it's low voltage, so there's no risk there. There is still a risk, because again, when we see the amount that can cause a shock or even electrocution, you're going to find that it's not that big anyway. Currents above 10 milliamperes. We mentioned that the current intensity is going to be measured in amps or amperes. A milliampere is 1/1000 of an ampere. So currents above 10 milliamperes can paralyze or freeze muscles, and that would be a relatively light shock. Currents more than 75 milliamperes can cause a rapid, ineffective heartbeat, and that will occur in a few minutes unless a defibrillator is used. So this is almost killing, 75 milliamperes. 75 milliamperes is not much current. A small power drill uses 30 times as much. You can imagine, just the power drill uses 30 times the amount that can lead to killing a person. So 1 milliampere, as it shows here at the bottom, is 1 over 1,000 of an ampere. Remember these numbers, by the way, the 10, the 75. Now, to give you an idea about when would you feel the shock, 3 milliamperes, we were talking about 10 and we're talking about 75, 3 milliamperes would cause a painful shock. And if that person, as we said before, is standing on a platform, that jolt might make them fall, so adding another injury which is got to result from fall. 10 milliamperes plus are going to cause muscle contraction, so you won't be able to let go. If you're holding that wire, you won't be able to let go. 30 milliamperes are going to cause lung paralysis, which is usually reversible and temporary. 50 milliampere might cause ventricular fibrillation, which might cause heart arrest. 10 milliamperes to 4 amperes, certain fatal ventricular fibrillation, which is not going to be reversible through a defibrillator. And over 4 milliamperes, in addition to that, that's going to be severe burns and heart paralysis. So, as you can see, it's really dangerous if you don't know what you're dealing with. The burns are the most common, and they are related to shocks. And they come from touching wires, touching electrical wiring or equipment that is improperly used or maintained. The hands, usually, which is the part of the body that touches this equipment or this wire, is going to be getting it. And it may be a very severe injury, depending, again, on the intensity of the current, the exposure, the time of exposure, the length of the time, and so on and so forth. So it needs immediate attention to try at least to minimize the long-term effects of that burn. Falls, as we just mentioned, is an indirect injury. Electric shock can cause indirect injuries. It can cause death if the fall is from a high level and there's no fall protection system. So workers in elevated locations who experience a shock may fall, resulting in serious injury or death, especially that if the person is in a case of shock, they won't be able to reduce the impact of their fall by using their hands or something like that. They might lose consciousness, and that might lead to death. Fire as the second indirect hazard, most commonly caused by current flowing through high resistance due to faulty wiring, igniting, insulation, and or other material. Something that you might remember from your physics classes, energy can change its form, which means we have the electrical current, which is electrical energy, and if there's very high resistance, as in a heater, for example, what happens is that this electrical energy is converted into thermal energy or heat. So in this case, if the current keeps flowing through high resistance, it's going to cause that high resisting material to heat up, and that might cause a fire. Heat created from high currents flowing through a wire. This is analogous to two objects being rubbed together very fast. Heat is generated through that friction. At full speed, the skin of a jet, for example, is around 600 degrees Fahrenheit. That shows you just the effect of friction, even flowing through air. The heat of friction, to maintain continuity of flow, as the diameter of a pipe decreases, the velocity of the fluid must increase, and the heat of friction increases as well. So think about it this way, the electrical wire or conductor, think about it as a pipe where there's a fluid flowing through it. If you narrow the cross section of the pipe, what's going to happen? The speed is going to increase. So I think that that's the Bernoulli effect or something like that. So likewise with wires, when a wire decreases in cross-sectional area due to damage, current must increase through that portion of the wire, and heat increases possibility to the point that surrounding materials are set on fire. If there's a pinch in a wire, for example, due to a sharp edge or a corner or being squeezed by a door jamb or something like that, what's going to happen is reduction in the cross section of the wire, and the intensity of the heat is going to increase. The heat is going to increase, which might melt the insulation shield and start the fire. The third indirect hazard is explosions, which can be caused when electricity provides the ignition source or arc jumping through an air or fuel mixture in the atmosphere. So in fact, the arcing effect can happen without direct connection, without directly touching. So it can happen through the air. The air itself, in this case, is going to act as the conductor. So the six hazardous electrical conditions are going to be exposed. We talked about six hazards, but six conditions here, which is something totally different. What might cause that electrical overcharge that might lead to a shock or to electrocution or to arcing? So we have exposed electrical parts that are not properly insulated, proximity to power lines, the arc effect that we talked about, inadequate wiring, which in this case you have too much current flowing through a very narrow wire, which is going to lead to, again, overheating. It's similar to reducing the cross section of the conductor. Defective cords, poor or no grounding, so the excess charge cannot be discharged to the ground, and overloaded circuits. Again, if the circuit carries a flow of a certain intensity exceeding the design capacity of that circuit. Look at this picture, for example, here. This is something taken from a construction site, and you can see here exposed electrical parts. Here are the six hazards that we talked about, and this is the first one. The box cover was removed and the wiring was exposed. So first of all, we have several issues here. Even the connection between different wires is not done properly, so that can lead definitely to electrocution or to at least shocks. So if you have a junction box, you should use either covers or guards or barriers. So you have to guard the live parts, the parts that receive current of electric equipment operating at 50 volts or more, against accidental contact. Obviously here the connections are not done properly and there's no proper insulation. So to protect, the control number one, isolate electrical parts. We're going to use either cabinets or boxes or fittings. The conductors going into them must be protected, and unused openings must be closed. Of course, here we have an unused opening that's not properly closed. They try to close it with something like duct tape, and that's not a proper closure for such an opening. So this is not properly done. Here we have the wires getting into that junction box, and again, it's closed using duct tape. That's not the proper closure. I think this picture speaks for itself. You have a junction box. It does not have a cover. You have openings that are not properly closed. So here, at least two violations in this picture. And again, the connections here are not done in any professional way, by the way. The second hazard is going to be the power lines. Do not get near power lines. Whether on dry conditions or even on wet or dry conditions, you should not get too close to a power line if it is still activated. If someone's going to work on power lines, they must be deactivated. Watch for cranes, ladders. What can get you close to the power line? Cranes, ladders, scaffolds, backhoes, scissor lifts, and raised dump truck beds. The problem with cranes is that the person might not touch the wires, but part of the crane, which is metal, is going to touch that wire, so it's going to close the circuit, and the person might get electrocuted. Same thing with a ladder. If the ladder touches, and if it's something like an aluminum ladder, for example, touches the wire, and again, that's going to cause the closing the circuit, which is going to electrocute the person standing on that ladder. Same thing for the scaffold. Now for the ladders, we're going to see later that you should not use any metal ladders close to electricity. There are some other alternatives, whether it's wood or fiberglass, for example, that can be used in the proximity of a power line. So the general rule is keep away at least 10 feet from the power line. And you have to post signs to warn people that you are working close to an active power line. So warnings of danger. Assume, if you don't know whether the line is hot or activated or not, always assume that it's hot. Use no metal. Use wood or fiberglass ladder, as we just mentioned, not metal ladders. And always use PPE, personal protective equipment, whether it's related to guarding against electrocution or fall protection as well. So power line workers need special training and personnel protective equipment. De-energize, if you're going to work above ground power lines, de-energize before working on them, lock out and tag out, or power provider to de-energize. So either you lock out that power line or you call the provider to deactivate it or de-energize it, or guard or insulate the lines if you're going to need to work close to them while they are still active. Some electrical workers need to do that while the lines are active, so make sure that you guard or insulate the lines so you do not get in direct contact with them. For underground power lines, we talked about above ground. Now for underground power lines, always call before digging. There's one call where it's a certain number that you're going to find it. If you don't know whether there are power lines underground or not, call and they're going to give you the paths of these power lines. Always locate and de-energize before digging, because again, if the blade of the backhoe or the digger hits that activated power line, that's going to cause a continuation of closure of the circuit and continuation of the flow of electricity. Recall one call if in doubt. If obvious signs of utilities, whether they're power boxes, poles, etc., exist, but they are not marked, whether they're active or not, call for the locator to remark before working. So better be safe than sorry. The number three, control number three, use correct wire, because the defective wires might cause electrocution, might cause fires, so use the proper and correct wire. Select wire size based on operation, building materials, electrical load, and environmental factors. So if it's going to be indoors versus outdoors, for example, if it's going to be heavy use versus light use, use fixed cords, not flexible cords, because again, that's going to reduce the possibility of dislocation and reduce the possibility of tripping along these flexible cords. Use the proper and the correct extension cord, and as we can see in the picture, it must be a three-wire type and designed for hard or extra hard use. So there's going to be some sort of print on the plastic sleeve or insulation on that wire. It's going to show you exactly what are the proper working conditions for that particular type of wire. In case you're going to be using temporary wiring, temporary lighting is temporary. So on a construction site, during construction, before the permanent electrical fixtures are connected, if you're going to use temporary lighting, know that it's temporary and disconnect it after use. So remove it immediately upon completion of construction. Protect temporary lighting from breakage. So again, if you're going to be using equipment, ladders or studs, for example, transporting them or pipes or whatever, which might hit a light bulb and cause it to break and shatter, use bulb guards to protect them from this impact. Don't hang temporary lights by wires unless designed for this use. So use the proper fixtures to hang the temporary lights. Again, talking about temporary wiring, you must have breaker protection. All branch circuits must come from panel board and have breaker protection, so in case of an overload, that breaker is gonna disconnect automatically. No temporary wiring on floors, again, is gonna cause the possibility of tripping, so branch circuits cannot be run on floors. Wall outlets must have covers. If you're gonna have a wall outlet, even for temporary wiring, you must have a cover for that wall outlet. Protect conductors entering boxes, etc., from abrasion, especially if you're going to have a sharp edge in the box. Make sure that you have a smooth protection to prevent the abrasion and the cutting of the insulation or the pinching of the cross section of the wire. Close unused openings in junction boxes, as we have seen in the picture, which was not done properly, but now we know that you must have these plugs that are exactly the size of the opening and that would close it properly. If you're going to be working outdoors or in wet locations, you must have weatherproof enclosures that are going to be waterproof, basically. Protect hardware from water. Water and electricity are a very bad combination, so we're going to try to protect any hardware or any equipment, electrical equipment that we're working with, from contact with water. So we're going to make that protection through cabinets, boxes, switches, circuit breakers, etc. Here we have, for example, a cord that's going through a door opening, and if that door closes, what's going to happen is going to squeeze that cord, pinch it, and cause it basically to break the insulation, which is going to be a hazard, as we just discussed. So the causes of damage include aging, which is natural wear and tear if that cord has been used for a long time, edges of doors and windows, staples for fastening if you're going to attach it to a wall, abrasion from adjacent materials, whether it's a junction box that has a sharp edge, and impact from activity in the area. If something drops on that cord, it might cause that tear into the insulation cover. So insulate live wires, check before use. Use three wire type cords only that are going to have a grounding wire. Hard duty cords only. Use only cords marked for hard or extra hard usage, as we have seen in the print on the wire itself. And provide strain relief. Strain relief, if you have here, for example, this connection has a strain relief. This widened part here is called a strain relief. So again, if you pull from here, it's not going to cause any damage to the wire. Use only cords, connection devices, and fittings equipped with strain relief, and you're going to see it through, again, the widening at the neck or the edge of that wire. Don't pull on cords. If you want to disconnect it from a power supply, don't just pull the cord, but remove it properly by pulling from the plug itself. Remove cords by pulling on the plugs, not the cords, and use only hard service rated cords. Cords not marked for hard or extra hard use should not be used, or which have been modified must be taken out of service immediately because they cause a source of hazard. Again, we have some repetition here. If you're going to use extension cords, they have to be three wire type, hard duty or extra hard duty. Protect them from damage, again, from any of the reasons that we have mentioned on the previous slides. No pinch points. Make sure that there's no narrowing in the cross section of that wire. No nails, staples, etc. So if you're going to suspend them or you're going to attach them to a wall, use something other than a nail or a staple through the wire itself. Use plugs with ground pins, the three pins. One of them is going to be the ground pin. So path to the ground must be continuous. Use only plugs with ground pins. No missing ground pins. Sometimes people would just break that ground pin because they can't find a grounded socket. That would be a big risk that you're taking in this position. No reversing polarity. No grounded conductor can be attached to any terminal reversing its designated polarity. And it must have general disconnect, which is something like a main breaker must have a disconnect that allows all conductors to be disconnected from service entrance. So a master circuit breaker that can disconnect the whole area. repairs to extension cords. If there has been a tear or a some damage to an extension cord, you can repair only extension cords made out of 12 gauge or larger of that type of cord. So if it's less than 12 gauge, you should not try to repair it. Repairs must maintain the insulation, so the splices, by connecting, for example, or lengthening, must maintain outer sheath insulation properties, so no electrical tape. The electrical tape by itself is not going to be enough insulation, and strain relief must be provided. That's going to extend the service life of such a cord. Hazard number 5, we talked about grounding. Grounding is a low resistance a low resistance path from a tool to the earth to disperse unwanted current. As you know, the earth has an infinite resistance. So any excess current, if it's sent to the ground is going to be able to absorb it without any problems. When a short occurs, energy flows through the ground and not through you. The short circuit basically is a discontinuity in the amount or intensity of the current flow. So you have a high intensity and an area of low intensity. If that happens, that's going to cause the shock or the electrocution. So there's no continuity. If you have grounding, the ground is going to absorb that difference. If you do not have grounding, then the person who is in contact with such a wire will have to absorb that difference, and it can be fatal. This picture, for example, shows an improper connection. Of course, there's no strain relief. For example, the wire is not properly connected, so tools plugged into improperly grounded circuits may become energized. A broken wire or plug on an extension cord are going to cause electrical shock or electrocution. So grounding is a very common OSHA violation. Here, what's wrong with this picture? It's missing the third element here, which is the ground part. It has strain relief, which is good, but again, the grounding wire has been removed or broken. Ground your equipment. Power supply systems, electrical circuits, and equipment have to be grounded, and inspect frequently to make sure that the path to the ground is continuous. Inspect before each use to make sure that the equipment is in a proper working condition, and don't remove the ground prongs. Again, the problem here in this picture is that the ground prong has been removed. Never do that. The last one is overloading circuits. The hazards result from too many devices plugged in to one circuit, causing heated wires and possibly a fire. If you do not have a proper circuit breaker, which can alert you in case of overloading, if you have the proper circuit breaker, it's going to trip first and disable that circuit, so everyone's going to be safe. If you do not have that circuit breaker, then the current is going to keep flowing, which is going to cause that heating and may lead to fires. Using damaged tools without the proper insulation may cause the overheating. And no, in case you don't have any overcurrent protection, that can cause the overloading of circuits. So if you don't have any fuses, circuit breakers, or GFCIs, as we're going to see in the next few slides. So here, for example, it doesn't appear that we have any of the above. The hazards are going to result from melting the wire insulation, because again, there's too much heat flowing through the current due to the resistance, which is going to melt the insulation. This situation can cause arcing and a fire in the area where the overload exists, even inside a wall. That's very dangerous. The electrical circuit protective devices, predominantly the circuit breakers, they automatically open the circuit if unsafe current is detected. They shut off the electricity. So for example, the fuse is gonna melt. The fuse is a thin wire of a certain material that's easy to melt if heated too much. You have these at home, you have these in your car, for example. One of the very common mistakes, each one of these fuses is rated for a certain current intensity. If you replace a defective fuse with one that has a higher current intensity, that's very dangerous because, again, it's going to allow for more current to flow, causing the hazard to occur. The circuit breakers are going to trip. The circuit breakers are reversible. So if it trips, you can reconnect it again. And the GFCIs are going to isolate the load. These are all protections to your circuits. The GFCIs protect you from shock. You can see the GFCIs in your bathroom, for example. You're going to find this. This is a ground fault circuit interrupter, which is the GFCI, and it has a reset button. So again, when it feels there's a drop in the current or a discontinuity in the intensity of the current, it's going to trip and stop that circuit immediately. So it detects current drop between the black and white wires. The GFCI cuts the electricity off in 1/40th of a second if a ground fault is detected. So if it detects that there's a difference in the intensity and the ground cannot take that, it's going to cut off the current in 1/40th of a second very quick. Use GFCIs on all 120 volt single phase 15 and 20 ampere receptacles, or have an assured equipment grounding conductor program. Now, this is a portable GFCI. Here it connects to the socket and here it connects to the device, and it has a movable GFCI here for temporary use. This one is permanent. It's going to be located in the wall. Again, GFCIs are designed to cut off a flow of electricity if a current leakage is detected in an electrical circuit, and designed to trip at 4 to 6 milliamps, relatively low current, which is still at the painful shock level, but at least it's less than the lethal. For temporary power, GFCIs or assured equipment grounding conductor program are required for all temporary power during construction, like the yellow one that we just saw. GFCIs are required on temporary 120 volts, 15 to 20 ampere outlets. And GFCIs are not required on permanent power unless the tool is used with an extension cord. In this case, you're going to need a GFCI. That's just a repetition of what we just said. Never snip off the ground prong on a plug. That will negate the safety feature of a GFCI, because again, the GFCI is going to measure the current going to the ground. So if the ground prong is not there, that renders it useless. Here's an example on how they work. Joe's outside with his power drill and it's raining. Again, as we mentioned before, electricity and water, very bad combination. Joe's standing on the ground, and since his drill is wet, there's a path from the hot wire inside the drill through Joe to the ground. If electricity flows from hot to ground through Joe, it would kill him, because he's going to absorb that difference in electricity. The GFCI senses the current flowing through Joe, because not all of the current is flowing from hot to neutral as expected. Some of it is flowing through Joe to ground. There's a current leak, and as soon as the GFCI senses that, it trips the circuit again between 1/30th and 1/40th of a second and cuts off electricity. Joe is going to be safe. GFCIs are going to be required on generators, all portable generators of 5 kilowatt or greater. Kilo means 1,000. A GFCI protection can be built in or added as a pigtail. The pigtail was the yellow one that we saw on the previous slide. Assured Equipment Grounding Program, or AEGP, is a specific written procedure adopted by the employer. If you cannot use the GFCI, then you must have an AEGP. All cord sets, receptacles, and any equipment connected by cord shall be inspected before each day use. That's part of the assured equipment grounding program. And this is a written program that must be kept on site. The OSHA inspector is going to inquire about it and he's going to check it. And it has to be implemented by a competent person in electricity. It covers equipment connected by plug and cord, all cords, plugs, and receptacles that are not part of the building or the structure, the temporary ones, and any power tool. Before first use, you're going to test, and you're going to test at least every 3 months, and after service, if any repair or maintenance has been done, and after possible damage, if it has been hit, for example, by something and you replaced it or repaired it, then you're going to inspect it and test it again. Test records must be kept. Again, this is going to be part of the inspection done by the OSHA inspector. The electrical equipment must be inspected before installation and to make sure that it's suitable for the intended use. Use per the manufacturer's instructions, which are going to be listed in the manual, labeled on the equipment itself, and certified equipment to be used per manufacturer's instructions. Label all the breakers. All circuit breakers must be labeled with the capacity that they can carry. Now, access to 50 plus volts must be controlled either by restricted areas or by a physical location. Restricted area means it's going to be accessible only by qualified or authorized persons. So basically, you're going to have a locker or a room or an enclosure or a partition or something like that, and only allowed personnel are going to be able to access it. Or by physical location, by elevating it 8 feet or above the floor of working surface, so no one is going to bump into it by accident. Electrical equipment as well must be protected. Enclosures or guards must be used where electrical equipment is exposed to physical damage. Electrical rooms must be marked. The entrances to electrical rooms containing exposed live parts must be marked with warning signs forbidding entrance by unqualified personnel. If you're going to do some splicing of the conductors, must use splicing devices designed for that purpose, like wire nuts, or by brazing, welding, or soldering to make sure that there's a good connection between the two wires being spliced. Manufacturer's information must be legible. If there's going to be a stamp on the wire or something like that designating its capacity, this must remain easily legible on that wire. So electrical equipment must not be used unless the manufacturer's name, trademark, and other markings giving voltage, current, wattage, etc. are legible. Again, as a means of protection. If you're going to have an electrical equipment enclosure for 600 volts or less, these working spaces cannot be used for storage. They're going to be primarily only for electrical equipment. So they're not used for storage. They're not used for partial occupancy. They must have access and elbow room allowing for people who are going to make any maintenance or repair or connections to work inside. Sufficient access and working space must be provided and maintained around all electrical equipment. And workspace clearances are going to be according to table K1 in your code book. 3 square feet in front of the electrical equipment in the direction of access to the live parts, that's the minimum that must be available. You must lock out and tag out controls on equipment during service and repair with clear identification that this equipment is defective and it needs maintenance or repair. To prevent energizing circuits, circuits or equipment that are de-energized must be locked and tagged to prevent unauthorized re-energizing at any point. So here, for example, we have a lockout. Basically, you turned it off and you have a lock that is going to disable you from reactivating it unless you have the key to that lock. So apply locks to power source after de-energizing. Tag deactivated controls. Tag de-energized equipment and circuits at all points when they can be energized, just to make sure that no one energizes them by mistake. and the tags must identify the equipment or the circuits being worked on. This, for example, is a single lock that locks only one circuit or the access to one circuit, and this is a multi-lock where you can have six locks attached to that. Here we have the enclosure clearly marked as high voltage with the danger sign. So use barriers or guards like this, for example. Pre-plan work and post warning and use protective measures, including protective equipment, and keep work areas clear of cores, debris, or trip hazards so that no one can trip inside that room. Here, obviously, we have a cord that's totally defective because the insulation is worn out and the wire is exposed. So don't use worn or frayed cords. Don't fasten with staples, as we just mentioned. Don't hang from nails. Don't suspend objects with them. Plan your work with others. Here we have lockout, tagout. So here we have the lock and the tag on a circuit breaker. Plan your to lock out and tag out equipment. Remove jewelry that can get the, hung on these wires or cause tears in these wires. Avoid wet conditions and avoid overhead power lines. Use proper hardware. This is a GFCI, as we mentioned. Use and test them. The switches, check them. The insulation, check it to make sure that there's no tear. Extension plugs, use three prong types. Make sure that the ground prong is there. Extension cords, use only when necessary and assure in proper condition and right type for job, whether it's hard use or heavy or extra hard use, and heavy duty or extra heavy duty. And the connectors, use the correct ones. Train the employees to use safe practices, including de-energizing before starting to work. Use only cores, tools, etc. that are in good condition. Lock out and tag out procedures. You have to train them on that. And you have to train them on using the proper personal protective equipment. So as a summary, these hazards are inadequate wiring leading to overheating or overloading of the circuit, exposed electrical part leading to electrocution or shock by touch, bad insulation on wiring, ungrounded tools and electrical systems, overloaded circuits, damaged power tools and equipment, wrong personal protective equipment and tools, overhead power lines working too close to overhead power lines, and wet conditions make all hazards worse. The protective measures are going to be proper grounding, using GFCIs, using fuses and circuit breakers, guarding live parts, lock out and tag out on the equipment that needs maintenance or the circuits that need maintenance, proper use of flexible cords. Again, do not pull from the cord itself, but from the plug. Close electric panels if they're going to include electrical equipment, and train personnel for the knowledge of the hazards and how to deal with these hazards to minimize their occurrence. Some quick questions. At what amperage will a GFCI trip? Do you remember the number? 4 to 6 milliamperes. What is the proper way to repair an extension cord? Repair only, the only ones that can be repaired are 12 gauge or larger. Repair must maintain insulation properties, and a shrink sleeve can be used to, for that connection. And you have to make sure that the properties of the wire or of the conductor are clearly printed and are legible on that extension cord. What should we do to protect unauthorized employees from entering electrical rooms with live parts? We mentioned two measures. One of them is the physical, and the other one is marking the room with the warning signs forbidding entrance by unqualified and unauthorized persons. What types of electrical cords are acceptable for use in construction? Usually three-wire type, hard or extra hard duty, heavy or extra heavy duty. These are the only cords that are extension cords that are properly used in construction sites. That's basically our presentation on electrical hazards, subchapter K. I hope you have learned a few things to keep you safe when working with electricity. See you in another lecture.